Hello, pals. It's been a little bit of a while since I've chatted to you. I hope this finds you all thriving in whatever endeavours you are attempting. And if it doesn't find you thriving, I look forward to talking about your endeavours on this podcast at some point in the future. Once more, we get to welcome a new person to the Worst Foot flock. We have our 75th Patreon donor. Hello, Gretchen Sovey. And I hope I have pronounced all of your names in the correct manner. Gretchen has gone for the classic annual pledge, where I am led to believe by our friends at Patreon, you get a cheeky little discount if you tot up your monthly donation, and then they take, I think, 10% off. So we all get the best of both worlds. Gretchen is giving us a fiver a month. So as you all know by now, I imagine she gets to choose which topic we do, and she's come up with a banger of the world's worst librarian. So we will be popping into our own Dewey decimalized system of potential guests and finding the correct one to talk about. I imagine the good ones, like Alexandria and the House of Wisdom in Baghdad, and the bad ones, like, I don't know, Hitler's personal collection. So thank you so much for that, Gretchen. And talking of Patreon, as I'm sure you may well know, and if you don't, listen up carefully. We are putting on our next live show in 13 days' time, thanks to the kind support of our first 70 donors. I'll be honest, friends, we are extremely lucky to have pretty respectable hordes of listeners. As Barry pointed out in a previous podcast, we may have slightly miscalculated as a business model because a lot of you don't live in the United Kingdom. So, if you do live in the United Kingdom within, I'm going to say 30 miles of London, I may up that range to 50 in next week's introduction, and are free on Sunday the 10th of October at 7:30 p.m, get yourself to the Backyard Comedy Club in Bethnal Green. It is one of my favourite comedy clubs in the country. You might have seen clips online of me messing about there. Laughter just comes out the walls. Laughter's going to come out of the walls and the stage while we're there, because we're joined by three of our best pals, Beck Hill, Jay Foreman, and Ria Lena, each one of them stand-up comedy heavyweights. And we are going to be celebrating some of the worst poetry, theatre, cabaret, burlesque, and music along with them. As you'll know, if you're a Patreon supporter, then you'll get a cheeky little discount. Want to find out the discount code? Head to patreon.com/worstfootforward and sign up. If you're not, it is still a very affordable £7 a ticket, and the ticket link is in the notes to this show. For the rest of you who don't live in and around London, or indeed in and around the United Kingdom, by thunder, find yourself a London-dwelling family or friend and send them our way. I guarantee we'll give them the sort of night out the likes of which they have never seen before and may never want to see again. So, please do help plump up our audience for what should be an absolute banger of a show. I think that's pretty much all bases covered. You know what to find us on Twitter, at Worstfoot, at Ben Vandeveld, at Baz McStay. You know to email us on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. And you know that if you want to rankle us online, talk to Barry about Europe's capitulation in the Ryder Cup today, or my own football team's capitulation over the past 15 to 20 years. But now we're going to do another Patreon episode requested by our friend Isabel Adams. It is time to saddle up for an hour and a bit about the world's worst cowboys. Howdy, partners, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the rootinest, tootinest celebration of heroic failure. Been thrown from a bucking bronco into a vat of tar before stumbling into a pillow factory the night you're meant to be taking your girl to the line dancing? This is the show for you. Having trouble avoiding the affections of an oversexed steer, no matter how much you do to persuade them that you are incompatible? Saddle up, my friends. want to be complicit in decades upon decades of genocide, which wiped out hundreds of unique, untouched cultures that regard property rights with disdain and contain remarkable alternative worldviews on gender, leadership, horsemanship, and community. Sure, why not? And joining me on this journey through the frontier, the often misrepresented and exploited Sacagawea, to my own manifestly destined Lewis and Clark, it's Barry McStay.
You call me a sack of what now?
Yeah. Sacagaweas. I believe that Lewis and Clark were led into the Wild West by a collection of grumpy Glaswegians in headscarves. Not headscarves, headdresses. Does that mean... Very different things. Does that mean the indigenous people of America are the opposite of modest Muslims? Because the headscarf and the headdress are very much at either end of the headwear spectrum.
I for one, am not going to try and decide what the differences between those two unique cultures about which I do not have enough knowledge to judge.
Oh, look, that is how a lawyer answers a setup to a judge. Why did the chicken cross the road? Well, my lord, there are a number of variables at play.
I am very excited about this episode because it's a Patreon one, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Well, let us do our due diligence on that immediately. Hello to Isabel Adams, who is a £5 a month Patreon supporter and requested that we do the world's worst cowboy. Another example of a Patreon donor suggesting a topic where me and Barry immediately went, of course.
Yeah.
Why did we think, didn't we think of that?
Yeah. It should be, I mean, it's such a rich, it's one of those like big monolithic things that we know loads of the names and loads of the heroes and the stories, and diving down deep behind it and trying to find some of the lesser known bits and bobs has proved quite entertaining. Yeah.
I feel like you and me are a generation too young to have really played cowboys and Indians a lot. I mean, obviously, again, growing up as a second-generation Jewish immigrant, any childhood game that sort of tipped its hat to enormous amounts of genocide was not a massive... You know, I used to play investors and hedge fund managers as a child.
That's more like Kiss Chase, though, isn't it?
Yeah. No, Kiss Chase is when I dressed up as Gene Simmons, got all the wrong ideas in the playground. But I was, like, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe I'm naive, but I was in the post office the other day, and you know, like, all good post offices have knock-off Poundland children's toy tat, and in amongst them was a Winchester rifle and an AK-47, a plastic one, and it just seemed so strange that you were offering those up as toys for children to play
with. Now you look back on it, you go... Hang on a second. What? Water pistols are like one step below, and then but then you go, oh, the whole like cowboy set you could get as a kid. You've your Colt 45 or your six shooter. You go, this, when you take a step back from it all and zoom out just a touch, it's something very like skin crawly about it. My parents were very hot on not letting us have guns as kids.
As kids growing up in the historically stable
of Ireland,
of Ireland.
They think that maybe they were seeing a greater game behind it all than I was.
Yeah, just sort of in mid-December, you're like, "Mummy, Daddy, my face is so clothed. Please, can I wear a ballet?" No.
Listen, let's get our guest on board. We need another member. We're going to be the Magnificent Three today, so let's introduce the third. Our guest today is, I think, the only guest we've had on the show so far who has had a review from Prince Charles, who called him amazing. Then again, this is the opinion of a man who talks to petunias, so let's take his words with a grain of salt, shall we? However, amazing is an epithet applied across the board about our guest. According to The Scotsman, the newspaper, not a random guy called Hamish, he is undoubtedly one of the greatest variety artists working today. He's been working for over 30 years as a street performer, cabaret artist, juggler and entertainer, winning critical acclaim and more silverware than the Williams sisters. He's given a TEDx talk, is a member of the Magic Circle, appeared at a Royal Command performance and wowed audiences across the Atlantic in America's Got Talent. One of his standout acts on that show involved a knife act where he managed to not stab Terry Crews' hand. But then again, I have also not stabbed Terry Crews' hand. So where's my amazing review, Prince Charles? Between consulting on Hollywood movies, writing articles for numerous publications, and now taking to the podcast airwaves with his show Imagination and Junk, there seems no limit to this man's abilities, but he's usually at his most comfortable in front of a live audience with nothing more than a tablecloth and hope, which sounds just like me at that toga party back in Freshers Week. Please welcome the extraordinary gentleman, Matt Ricardo.
Fill your hands, you sons of bitches. It's a thing a cowboy says. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for sounding more authentically Old West than I could ever manage. Yeah.
I've been poking cat. No, hang on. No. Cat cowpoke isn't a compliment, is it?
It doesn't sound like one.
I've just realised what it probably pertains to, and I'm going to feel like...
Fill your hands, you sons of bitches, by the way, should be your new, like, first line at the start of your act, because absolutely...
You know where that's from? That's John Wayne at the end of True Grit.
Is it?
Yeah. Is it? I was going to say, it's got the same rhythm as Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. Yeah. I imagine the same sort of meaning.
And listen, you have conquered the West in the shape of America, so to speak. How was it meeting the cowpoke, Simon Cowell?
Him. I didn't meet him. I was there for a week and a half. I didn't meet him. He was, you know, he judged me. Yeah. Oh, he judged me, and harshly. Yeah. But the closest I got to him was, you know, what people saw on television. I think because perhaps he had heard of some of the things that I'd said about him in previous shows of mine, which on reflection now was not, I wasn't thinking long-term.
Yeah. Can you give a bit of context for that? Because it was surprising to some people for you ending up on ATG.
Well, yes. I had always said that I wouldn't do it because it's awful. You know, I think we can all agree that it's awful.
I wouldn't be a member of any club that would have me as a member, that sort of stuff.
Exactly. You know, I'd always kind of thought, well, you know, and this seems kind of a little bit wanky, but, you know, as a performer, you know this, the people that are qualified to judge you are your audiences, and that's it, and that's all you should care about. So these weird, you know, Botoxed gazillionaires who don't know anything about entertainment and have a button that rejects you or accepts you. It's just awful. But then they invited me. And
and they were so nice and laid on such a lovely buffet.
Previously, I had done this show where I'd learned a bunch of skills suggested by complete strangers on the internet. Mm. It was called Matt Ricardo versus the World, where the premise of the show was I would invite anonymous strangers on the internet to challenge me to learn things they thought I couldn't learn, which is a stupid thing to do because people on the internet are just the worst. But it was kind of fun, and I learned a bunch of new skills, and I learned to pick locks and throw knives, and it's brilliant.
Yeah. The really impressive thing would be picking a lock by throwing a knife at it.
You see, now you've said that, you know what I'm like.
Yeah.
This
is the problem of being a man with your skills. Things that in any other setting would just be a normal pub what-if conversation. As soon as you hear it, you're like, yeah, I think I can have a go at that.
Yeah, that is literally how I pay the mortgage. But so one of the challenges I got for that show was somebody that knew my feelings about talent shows and said, I challenge you to go on America's Got Talent. So I did. And I did it as a way of collecting an experience to put in, you know, to make into a new show. And I did it, and I wrote this piece about my experience, and I submitted it through my agent to America's Got Talent's lawyers to make sure that I could publicly say these things. And they said that if I did, I'd be sued to oblivion.
Huh.
So that was the end of that story.
At any point, did you have the temptation to take one of the dangerous props that you have secreted about your person and level it at the judges?
Well, funny you ask. So I, as you mentioned, I do that knife trick with Terry Crews. I wanted to do it with Simon Cowell. And he was very not comfortable with that idea. He didn't want to get close to me holding a knife.
That's reasonable to be. So I've seen you do what does feel like a very Old West trick, which is the one where you, or maybe it's an old pirate trick, who knows? But it could be in either setting, where you lay your palm down on a table and then go in and out between your fingers. And everyone's very impressed. And then you go, well, that was a bit too easy. And you cover your eyes with tape and dough and a sack. And then you do it. And watching that from 10 foot away is pretty nerve-wracking. So on this one occasion, I am going to empathise with Simon Cowell.
old fingers, Ricardo. Here.
No, old finger, Ricardo. And that is the problem. This is the one thing that I love about your act that makes it so appropriate for this show. We have had many performers on the show who appropriately could perform in a club or a theatre, as could you. But the ideal setting for your act is a saloon. And that is why you're so appropriate to this show.
It's because I wear feathers in my hair, a corset and fishnets.
Now we know that you are a man of remarkable myriad skills with all sorts of everyday and rare weaponry. But what is it that you are worst at in the world?
Yeah, I am one of those people that has made his living by collecting skills. Hmm. I cannot sing, and I wish I could. But I can do everything else like a little bit. I'm like an old sort of, you know, vaudevillian. I can't dance well, but I can do a couple of steps. I can do it enough. What they call in the world of magic, a convincer. Just enough. I can play a couple of instruments just enough to make people think I can play them. Cannot hold a tune to save my life. And once I was forced to do a duet on stage in front of a full audience in a theatre with Barbara Windsor. And I can't sing. And I think I'm the only person in the world who has this beautiful memory of being midway through a verse of a song, completely destroying the song, like mauling it, and looking over to like 3 feet to my right, there's Barbara Windsor just staring at me with this look of, what the hell are you doing? It was brilliant.
Good. Yeah. And probably channeling 50 years of comedy British heritage through her eyes and Richter's grin.
Yep.
Going, this is where I have come to.
Why are you on the stage in my show doing this?
That's amazing. Because there is that whole, you know, Jack of all trades, master of none thing, which I saw someone posted sort of the fuller version of that quote the other day, which is slightly less unflattering, which is but still better than master of one, which I think is quite nice. You can be a jack of all trades, is, you know, it's better to be good at, you know, fairly good at a lot of things, I would say. And you know, if you can't do singing, it's fine, you can still juggle knives and pull one tablecloth off one laid table onto another laid table.
Exactly. I think
I would rather someone hired you to do that at their wedding as they walk down the aisle than sing.
Well, no, surely the thing to do is to pull a dress off one of the bridesmaids onto the bride.
kind of melding of my act and Buck's fizz. And who hasn't thought about doing that? I mean, I'm very much the Cheryl Baker of modern variety.
Yeah.
But as your act has proven, you're quite bad at making your mind up about what it is you want to do. Now, I've tried my best to stick rigidly to cowboys and not go down the route of outlaws necessarily. I've left that massive freeway open to both of you. So I'd read a little bit about, you know, the Wild West, which a lot of the things I read online were like, you can define the Wild West as both a time and a place. So geographically, it was the part of the USA to the west of the Mississippi River, but also historically, it's that sort of the latter half of the 19th century into the early 20th century, during which, as Ben mentioned, Manifest Destiny swept across North America as the sort of the idea that the US government had, that it was inevitable and the divine right of the European settlers to expand westwards towards.
It is fascinating how Americans love to cosplay that part of their history, and we like to cosplay World War II a lot. But But the difference is that lifestyle still exists.
Well, that's it. Yeah, cowboys are very much still around, and they're not just an American. They're not just an American thing either. You get them in any countries, but particularly the larger countries where ranching is a thing, so Mexico and Australia. And so, in fact, the cowboy tradition in North America originated from the vaqueros, who were horsemen and cattle herders in Spain. They first came to California with the Jesuit priest Eusebio Kino, and I was raised by Jesuits. We didn't have them teaching us how to ranch cattle across vast 1,000-acre ranches and so on. But they were the first cowboys to come over there, and that word vaquero is probably where we get the term buckaroo to this day, which is quite nice. But you get, you know, there was cowboys and horsemen, cattlemen in Hawaii as well. The Hawaiian Paniolo, also a direct descendant of the vaqueros. They think that Paniolo is a Hawaiian version of Espanol, because Hawaiian doesn't have an S in it, and all syllables and words have to have a vowel at the end of them. So Paniolo, Espaniolo, that's where that comes from, apparently. And they learned their skills from the Mexican vaqueros. But yeah, in the early 19th century, there's a guy called Captain George Vancouver who gave some cattle to Kamehameha. Hawaiian. I am not good at Hawaiian names. To Kamehameha, who was the monarch of the Hawaiian kingdom.
You sounded like you were trying to pronounce something while your tongue was burnt there.
Yeah, I was being branded at the time.
Yeah.
But apparently his cattle that he gave him were phenomenally fertile, and they just exploded across the islands, and they were wreaking havoc across the countryside. So the king, basically, there was a sailor who ended up on the islands, a European sailor ended up on the islands, and he was given permission by Kamehameha to capture these cattle again. So I'm just having these visions of cattle roaming wild and with wild abandon across Hawaii. And the way they caught them was they would drive them into pits dug into the forest floor, which is very sort of Wile E. Coyote, Elmer Fudd style. But yeah, what else did I read about? I just sort of read about some of the, you know, the daily life of a cowboy. The reason they were needed is that, particularly in these early days, it was lots of public land. There wasn't sort of fenced off areas, and it was very arid and dry, particularly in the American South. So vast herds of cattle needed to cover vast areas of land in order to find enough sustenance. And so they'd have a string of 3 or 4, 5 cowboys, plus a cook and a line leader, or the guy who was their head honcho, just following them around, making sure they didn't walk off cliffs or get captured or anything like that. And so they'd live away from home for weeks on end, living off beans and dried meat and coffee and stuff. And they were paid maybe $25 to $40 a month. Now, the price of a steer was $4 a head in Texas, but it could be $40 a head in the North, because after the Civil War, there was loads of, you know, beef supply had been run into the ground by the war.
Well, and also all the Confederate cattle stayed south of the Mason-Dixon line, whereas all of the cattle who didn't believe in slavery went up north.
Yeah, and indeed, many cowboys had been Civil War soldiers from the North and the South. And actually, a quarter of cowboys were freed ex-slaves. There are a lot of Black and African-American cowboys. I read a little bit about some of those.
Yeah, that's one of those facts from history that a lot of modern people don't like to talk about.
Yeah. Bill Pickett was born in 1870 to former slaves. He was one of the biggest rodeo stars in the early days of the rodeo. And his big trick was he would catch a steer on the run by biting its lip.
Oh.
What?
Yeah. There's this act called bulldogging, which they still do in shows, but involves you sort of jumping off your horse onto the back of a steer to sort of wrestle it to the ground.
Okay.
And his version of that is he watched ranch dogs would catch wandering cattle by biting their lips. So he taught himself how to do that.
So this is
a man biting a steer's lips, yes.
Whilst it's moving.
Yes, Ben, I don't see why this is so difficult for you to comprehend.
It feels like what might have actually happened is that someone caught him kissing an animal and he had to come up with a, you know?
Well, apparently he drew applause and admiration from young and old, according to this guy whose review I read.
In my mind, but like what I've immediately gone to is the opening credits of Back to the Future, where Marty McFly hitches a lift on the back of a car with a skateboard. Like that, but backwards and with a cow.
Yeah, This one's coming to.
I appreciate that's a strange stage direction.
Yeah, that was how Ginger Rogers did her act, right? 40 years after he died in 1972, he was the first black honoree in the National Rodeo Hall of Fame. So he's pretty amazing. There's a guy called Cleo Hearn who's still alive. He's been a professional cowboy since 1959. In 1970, he became the first African-American cowboy to win a calf roping event at a major rodeo. And he was the first African-American to attend college on a rodeo scholarship. And he was the first African-American to portray the Marlboro Man.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
I like that.
Since the early 70s, he's been running a sort of a group called Cowboys of Color Rodeo. They recruit cowboys and cowgirls from diverse racial backgrounds and tour with over 200 athletes, as they're described.
You talked before about him being a rodeo scholar, and I'm just imagining a hilarious mix-up between a rodeo scholar and a road scholar, where a cowboy ends up at Oxford trying to lasso Sloan Rangers from other colleges.
While Bill Clinton ends up trying to bulldog a steer.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask Bill Clinton to bulldog something, then...
to be fair. And I love this guy, George McJunkin. He was born in 1856. He was an African-American cowboy and amateur archaeologist in New Mexico. He was born to slaves in Midway in Texas, and he was in this place called Folsom, New Mexico, after a flood which killed 18 people, and he went to assess damage to this ranch, and he was fixing up a fence, and he entered a sort of a little cave in Arroyo, and he discovered the remains of giant prehistoric bison, which had been exposed by the floodwaters washing away a load of the soil, and he recognized a type of stone tool which is now called a Folsom Point, which is very distinctive as well, and he recognized that this was really important. He left it undisturbed, recovered a few sample points, and basically tried to get archaeologists to come and look at this for years. This was 10 years it took him. He eventually sent some sample bones to the Denver Museum of Natural History, who sent a paleontologist to have a little look. And again, they didn't really do a deep dive into it. They didn't do a thorough excavation until 1926, at which point McJunkin had been dead for 4 years. Yeah, but it showed that basically this site showed that people had inhabited North America for some 7,000 years longer than people previously thought. So he was a really important discovery. Yeah. And I read about there was, plenty of cowgirls as well. And we should mention the likes of Mabel Strickland and Florence Hughes. And this lady I read about called Bonnie McCarroll, or Mary Ellen Dot Treadwell. She was a champion rodeo performer and bronco rider. And she won in the early days, rodeos were open to both sexes. She performed before Calvin Coolidge, who was the American president, and she had loads of fans all around the world. And there's a very famous photo of her being thrown from a horse called Silver. But in 1929, in what was to be her last competition, she was killed when she was thrown off her horse. It landed on top of her. And as a result of this, despite the fact that loads of men had died in bronco competitions up to this point, that led to the authorities going, "Whoop, we better ban women from taking part in this." And what? So women were banned from taking part in steer riding and rodeos as a result of the death of Bonnie McCarroll.
But the thing is, if you're a man and you die, you shake it off in a couple of days. It's just like when you get a little knock to your shin, you run it off and you're fine. Whereas if you're a woman and you die, that is permanent.
Yeah, you can walk it off. Nowadays, not all, but a lot of rodeo competitions are open to both sexes again. This one case of a fragile woman being crushed by but a mere horse. led to them reconsidering the entire deal.
A more lowbrow comic would at this point make an Empress Catherine of Russia joke, but I'm not that comic today.
No, you're not. You're the better man.
I am.
I didn't know this, that cowboys used to drink water from their Stetsons.
Is this where 10-gallon hat comes
I feel like
from?
A mass... I feel like a massive QI klaxon should go off at this point as well, Ben, because the 10-gallon hat doesn't literally hold 10 gallons of anything. That would be an enormous hat.
I'm just trying to work out, how many gallons does the average car fuel tank have?
I don't know. But yeah, a 10-gallon hat, would be, you'd look like Yosemite Sam, I think, with a 10-gallon hat on. Galon means braid in Spanish, and a lot of Spanish hats at the time had these braids on them, so a 10-gallon hat had 10 braids on it.
Oh!
But I imagine the fact that they drank from their hats may also have had some... you know, effect on the etymology. But yeah, Stetson hats used to be... John Stetson invented the one where you can sort of pull it off by the bowl of it rather than the brim with the sort of the crink in the side and the slit down the middle and all of that. But before that, the Stetson hat was it was this tall, more like an Amish hat nearly. So it's quite deep. And they could use... And it had sort of a lining on the inside, so you could use it to... Obviously, it would protect you from the sun, but also scoop up water for yourself and your horse.
I love the thought of Amish cowboys. Just yeah. Absolutely refusing to use horses because they're too modern a technology.
And I've two other little things I wanted to mention. The gunfight at the OK Corral, where did that take place?
I'm going to let you take the bullets here, Matt, because I know what I want to say.
Well, Matt's very good at catching bullets, of course.
Yeah. I'm going to say Leeds.
Yeah. it did not, well done, avoiding the obvious pitfall. It did not take place at the OK Corral. It took place six doors down. the OK Corral was a like a stables. Like a little stables. Okay. In Tombstone, the city of Tombstone. Now, Tombstone, in my head, Tombstone is like a one-horse town, one street with a, you know, a saloon and a water trough outside it and a bank and a few people here and there. Tombstone, in 1881... had restaurants, four churches, a bowling alley, an ice cream parlour, an opera house, a school, two banks, three newspapers, 110 saloons, 14 gambling halls, and, of course, numerous brothels.
So what you're saying is it was a one opera house town.
Yeah.
yes. Absolute backward yokels, not interested. Yeah.
So that was the year of the OK Corral, which was a shootout between Wyatt Earp and the lawmen alongside him. And his brother Virgil, who was actually senior to Wyatt Earp at the time, he was the town marshal.
Virgil Earp.
Yeah, I know. That just sounds like someone vomiting. Yeah. It's not really a name. And they were fighting against a gang called the Cowboys. And cowboy was considered a real like derogatory term at the time. In a guy who was a resident of Tombstone, George Parson, wrote in his diary, "A cowboy is a rustler at times, and a rustler is a synonym for desperado, bandit, outlaw, and horse thief." And the San Francisco Examiner wrote, "Cowboys are the most reckless class of outlaws in that wild country, infinitely worse than the ordinary robber."
You've just made me think of the Old West having one of my absolute favourite pieces of vocabulary of all time, which is the word for a, I'm going to say almost always a gentleman who steals cattle, which is a hornswoggler.
Yes. Yeah, well, they preferred cattleman, I think, as the term. So cowboy was a little bit, it's a bit diminutive comes on a cowboy.
Cattleman feels like it's gone through a politically correct Google Translate.
Yeah.
What do you do for a living? I'm a cattle person.
Bovine.
Yeah. Yeah. Bovine engineer. Although that sounds like you're getting on one of those skateboards on your back and going underneath and adjusting the udders. I can definitely get more horsepower out of that. And the cow's looking down going, I don't want more horsepower.
Yeah. And finally, I want to mention the camel boys rather than cowboys. Because a chap called Edward Fitzgerald Beale, who was a Texan war veteran, realised that horses were going to struggle somewhat in the deserts of southwestern America. And he suggested importing camels instead. Beale was quite an important figure. He became really famous in 1848 because he was the first guy to come back to the East in America with gold from California, contributing to the gold rush.
Huh.
But in 1855, he suggests the idea of having camels instead of horses. And then the Secretary of War, Jefferson Davis, later the President of the Confederacy, helped, you know, the US military import 75 camels and informed a US Army Camel Corps, one group stationed in Texas and the other group in California underneath Beale. But with the Civil War coming, the US Congress weren't, you know, too keen on spending money on importing camels. They thought, we might need to save up a little bit. And they also had pressure being put on them from big mule breeders. Mule breeders did not want camels taking their, you know, their business.
I'm just so glad that the camels didn't persist in America, because, well, then the band America would have had to sing the lyric, "I've been through the desert on a camel with no name," which just isn't as satisfying lyrically.
Well, this is the thing. Confederate forces captured the herd in Texas and let most of them free. Beale was perfectly correct. The camels were ideally suited to the desert. And not only that, most people in America hadn't seen them. So you get these tales across America in Arizona, New Mexico, till the turn of the 20th century, of the Red Ghost. People describing it as a terrifying beast with a terrifying rider strapped onto its back, which could take down a bear and disappear into the night. And when it was eventually caught, it was obviously just a camel. Please, that was feral.
Please tell me there are feral camels wandering around America to this day.
Sadly, not anymore. The last of them, I think, was spotted in the wild in the 1920s. And and then one was brought to Los Angeles Zoo and called Topsy and died in 1934. But yes, I do like this idea. And there are stories about cowboys seeing UFOs and weird beasts and things like
that. Don't worry about that, pal. More on that in a bit.
But my choice for the world's worst cowboy, I'm going for a big hitter. I'm going for Buffalo Bill Cody. For a couple of reasons. Mainly that I like the fact that by 1869, Bill Cody was 23 years old and he met a chap called Ned Buntline, who wrote Cody's adventures down in the New York Weekly and then published a novel, Buffalo Bill, King of the Bordermen, about this 23-year-old who basically made up his entire life story. He said he had been a trapper and a bullwhacker and a 59er panning for gold in Colorado and a wagon master and a stagecoach driver and, you know, a buffalo hunter, which he was. And he'd worked in the Pony Express for its brief existence, which, I mean, he did not. He did not ride for the Pony Express. But as a boy, he worked for its parent country.
What was so the instead of his Pony Express, sorry?
It was basically like a delivery service, a mail service, which involved people on horseback delivering posts. It was very brief because then obviously the railways were built and surpassed the Pony Express. But he told stories about riding, you know, vast distances on horseback and overcoming the trials of the wilderness. And he was basically carrying message on horseback from the firm's office in Leavenworth to the telegraph station 3 miles away. He was basically the delivery boy, the in-office delivery boy. Yeah. But then he went to Chicago off the back of this fame and debuted on stage with a friend of his, Texas Jack Omohundro, in the Scouts of the Prairie, which was a Wild West show, which, you know, involved, you know, sharpshooters and lasso tricks and all this stuff. Critics hated it. One critic said Cody's acting was like a diffident schoolboy. But he was hot, so the crowds loved him, and they sold out. And so he invited Wild Bill Hickok to join them the next year. Hickok didn't enjoy it either. He often hid behind the scenery. He was so shy. And in one show, apparently, a spotlight was focused on him, and he took his gun out and shot it.
Oh, we've all had gigs like that, Matt, haven't we? We're just like, I wish I could be on stage armed.
Yeah. About 10 years later, Cody founded Buffalo Bill's Wild West, which was, you know, a circus-type attraction. It had Calamity Jane and Annie Oakley. It would have reenactments of Custer's Last Stand, at the end of which, often you had a Buffalo Bill ride in and scalp an Indian as revenge for Custer at the end of it. And then they would often have Indian, you know, it had Cody taking part in these battles and these adventures that he never took part in at all. It was hugely famous all over the world. He went in 1887 to celebrate Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee. He performed for Queen Victoria in London and then did 5 months of a run in Salford near Manchester.
What?
Yeah.
Sorry, I can't. That's very difficult to compute that Buffalo Bill was wandering around an L.S. Lowry landscape.
Yeah, it really is. Not only that, he went to Rome, met Pope Leo XIII, didn't like the Colosseum, so refused to do his act there. He thought it was too run down.
Oh, I mean, I thought you were going to tell me that he was going to end up in a bit gun-slinging shootout with the Pope. Like, yeah. he's going for the guns, the Pope's going for the crucifix. Actually, yeah. Never do gun-slinging opposite a man who's got essentially a target drawn on him.
Yeah, that's very true. And the other thing, he got the nickname Buffalo Bill after the American Civil War. He had a contract to supply the Kansas Pacific Railroad with buffalo, with bison meat to feed all the workers. Cody claimed to have killed 4,282 buffalo in just 18 months, between 1867 and 1868.
That's some stint in the abattoir.
Yeah, right. Well, this is out in the wild. He and another hunter called Bill Comstock competed in an 8-hour buffalo shooting match. So they, to have the right to call themselves Buffalo Bill, Bill Cody or Bill Comstock.
Matt Ricardo, I have found a new challenge for you. How many buffalo do you think you could murder in 8 hours?
I mean, how is this not in the Olympics yet?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you why, Matt. Because the hunting of buffalo was so extreme that there were only 325 wild bison left in America in 1884. In 1870, 2 million had been killed in 1 year on the Southern Plains. Oh, there had been probably between 30 and 60 million of them a couple of centuries beforehand. But the one of the reasons, A, the expansion of the railroads, was this part of Manifest Destiny and expanding to the West and all of this stuff to feed the workers. And then there was the export of the meat to the North. And there was also this drive, particularly led by a lot of military men, to wipe out buffalo because it would aid in wiping out the Native Americans. There was a colonel in the 1860s told one wealthy hunter, kill every buffalo you can. Every buffalo dead is an Indian gone. And another general proposed medals with the dead buffalo on one side and Indians on the other be given to people who killed a certain amount of buffalo. The funny thing is, occasionally you come across things, in researching this, I came across things going like, well, even Wild Bill, even Buffalo Bill was saying we're endangering the buffalo and over-hunting is going to wipe them out. As if that was him being a conservationist. He's just remarking on a fact rather than saying, stop, everybody, stop. And I found this brilliant article by David Nesheim of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. How William F. Cody helped save the buffalo without really trying. And it quotes Cody saying, you know, not so much hunting as it was railroad building, opening the wilderness to civilization. The buffalo had to go as the first step in subduing the Indian. He said that the elimination of the buffalo was not wanton, it was necessary. He said that as of 1897, there was not enough buffalo left to repopulate the plains, even if it was desirable to restore them. So he clearly was of the opinion that, you know, it's fine to wipe these out. It's going to help the white European settlers to, you know, expand westwards. But the thing was, by having his show, he brought sort of buffalo around with the show. And in the early days, they had a photo, a lithograph in the program for the show of him and some cowboys out in the plains rounding up buffalo with lassos. And within a few years, they couldn't recreate this photo for the program anymore because there just weren't enough buffalo out in the wild to do it. And so they had a herd traveling around with them where they said these were the last of the only known native herd. But it spurred interest among people who came to see the show and young people and all of that, and some people who were genuine conservationists, in going, oh, if there's this few of them left, we've got to do something. And so there were already, by the 1880s and 1890s, efforts to to repopulate and save the buffalo. But that is by no means thanks to Buffalo Bill. And so for the dual reasons of his his very bloody hand in trying to wipe out the buffalo and in his completely self-made history and his show and his down-the-nose look at the Colosseum. That was the bit that stood out for me most, to be honest. I'm going to put forward Buffalo Bill Cody as the world's worst cowboy.
Firstly, the best cowboys. The best cowboy is the legendary anime series Cowboy Bebop. Right?
Yes, it is. It has a banging soundtrack.
Oh, doesn't it? Yoko Kanno's finest work. Second best cowboy goes to the Compton Cowboys. Do you know the Compton Cowboys? Oh, they're fantastic. I've got...
Compton is in... it's part of LA, right?
Yeah. There's a ranch... owned by these people called the Compton Cowboys, and they're people of color from disadvantaged background in LA who ride horses and dress as cowboys. And I first became aware of them because you saw photos of them on Black Lives Matter protests. And it's like, who the hell are these dope looking cowboys? And they do outreach stuff and community work, and they have kids out to learn to ride. It's fantastic.
There's a photo of one of them, I think, or is it in an ad of one of them riding a horse down that drain that they also use in Terminator?
they're, so that's the best cowboys. They're my, but but that's not why we're here.
No.
I just wanted to mention Cowboy Bebop. Did you see Jeff Bezos go to space?
This sounds like the setup for a joke. Yeah. No, I didn't see Jeff Bezos go to space.
It's all a bit of a joke, isn't it? Did you see what he wore when he came out of the spaceship? You are a cowboy hat. He thinks he's a fucking cowboy. Billionaire space cowboy Jeff Bezos.
Oh, I mean, I think I prefer Jamiroquai's version.
Yeah.
is it this whole sort of frontiersman idea? Is that what he's leaning into?
It's so desperate. It's so desperate. Please love me, please. I'm a real man. Look, see? Cowboy.
I think maybe it's also part of the fact that he realised that in a jumpsuit with his head, he just looks less like a penis if he puts a hat on.
This is a man who visually looks evil. He looks like every evil person in every film.
Yeah.
I think is coming down from your own space rocket wearing a cowboy hat is hard not to be channeling Slim Pickens from Doctor Strangelove straddling the bomb.
It's very canonical Bond villain Jeff Bezos.
Yeah. He thought to himself, I don't want to appear too untouchable. How will I have the common touch when I'm on television having just ridden to space in my own rocket? Put a hat on me.
See, Barry, now what you're making me hope for is that the pre-credit scene in the new James Bond is just Daniel Craig walking past an Amazon warehouse, looking at it, looking to camera, shaking his head and going, not worth it. And then onwards to the next one.
Yeah.
But he is not the worst cowboy. I'm not sure whether the original Marlboro Man counts as best or worst. His name was Robert Norris. He was a real cowboy. He wasn't a model or an actor. They were shooting at his real ranch and they happened to see him and they went, oh, he looks good. Literally, that's...
He died
at the age of 90, having never smoked a cigarette in his life.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Good or bad if you spend most of your life advertising cigarettes.
Wow. Did he? I think he quit as well because he thought it was. After a while, he thought,
he
I don't
quit.
Want my kids
smoking.
Yeah,
he quit because his kids, he would tell his kids not to smoke. And one day, one of his kids said, then why are you on all the billboards? So he quit.
Wow. I really hope that this guy, is he Norris?
Yeah, Robert Norris.
That he sort of ended up rooming in heaven with John Hewer, who was the first actor to play Captain Birdseye in the Fish Fingers Act over in the UK. They sort of like these actors who originate these roles, which are just for advertising purposes.
So I also got on my list Ronald Reagan, who, of course, got all of his fame pre-politics by playing cowboys. You know, he seems like a bad cowboy because when he was president, like the only gunfight he ever got in, he didn't do well. He didn't even pull his gun. So that's a bad cowboy, right? This is my last rejected worst. The Naked Cowboy from Times Square. Right?
Yes!
Robert Burke, who's a street performer. Now, he's not a street performer. I was a street performer. He hangs around in Times Square wearing a pair of white Speedos and white cowboy boots with a guitar, singing, and when people take photos, he asks them for money. Right?
Yeah.
So... he's a singer who wears a white Speedo and white cowboy boots. I just want to make this absolutely crystal clear. He is a singer who wears a white Speedo and white cowboy boots who calls himself the Naked Cowboy. He is neither naked nor a cowboy.
Bang to rights, my lord.
So I found out that he's a big Trump guy, and yes, he was in DC on January the 6th.
I mean, surely he'll be an easy enough one for the FBI to identify.
You would think, right?
Do you know he did? He did some adult film stuff as
well. Yes, he did gay porn. Yeah. But, I mean, who has?
Everyone's more than happy, welcome to do that. But I love that he's this, you know, image of whistle clean Americana that people go and take photos with in Times Square. I'm not sure so many tourists would have their children posing with him if they knew he'd appeared in Wide Nude World of Sports
in
1999.
World of Sports.
Never before
Hang on, the world has got to be either wide or nude. If it's both, then that's impressive.
I've never before heard the name of a porno film that sounded so much like it had commentators on it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you're going to make any bonus content, then there it is.
Yeah. A watch-along. Yeah, we'll have a watch-along party, listeners.
So, The Worst Cowboy. Here's my kind of angle on this. That everything that most people know about cowboys and the Wild West is completely wrong. It's one of those. The idea of white cowboys, which of course, as you've already said, they were mostly non-white, mostly Latino and African-American. The idea of those cowboys laying down the law, that they weren't lawmen, they were, again, you know, basically farm laborers, with exciting gunfights. Guns were rarely carried. Some towns that even made you check them into a safe place when you arrived in town. that it was a rough environment fit only for tough men. It was rough, but most of the makeup of the towns, commerce, entertainment, politics, schooling, religion, run by women. It was the entrepreneurship of women that created these towns in the first place. It's all wrong. Cowboys fighting with Indians, in quotes. Again, cowboys were not, you know, were farm laborers. All the indigenous American genocide was done by the government. It's all wrong. Non-white people, women completely erased. And it's all wrong because we learned it from Hollywood. And Hollywood learned it from Buffalo Bill Cody.
Yes!
So, yeah, we have the same Worst Cowboy. And how can it be anyone else? He was a cowboy in the loosest sense. What he was one of me. He was a circus carny showman who took this live arena spectacular around not just America, but around Europe as well, where he said he would show you the real Wild West. But what he really showed was this fictitious, whitewashed, simplistic version where noble white men fought rampaging savages that was all designed to make him look like a hero. He was he was the circus Trump of his time. It was all about him.
I was going to say it's sort of like a mixture of Elvis Presley and what he did to the blues and P.T. Barnum.
Exactly. It's what white American pop culture has always done, taken someone else's culture and pretend it's theirs and do a shitter version.
The thing that sort of like I find really strange about this is it feels a little bit like if like Field Marshal Montgomery took the World War II show on the road in 1946. It's so immediate that he's just going like, this has just happened.
But then people don't have, they don't have television then. There are TV shows reliving fairly recent events. I mean, I can't remember when United 93 came out, but it was not long after 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, I find it quite odd that we're already getting COVID TV dramas and things
like that.
And we're still,
it's happening.
But you're right. He's just gone, this is my day-to-day life, but I'm going to sprinkle stardust and bullshit all over it and take it on the road.
Hang on, Barry. Speaking as a stand-up comedian, taking my everyday life and sprinkling stardust and bullshit on it is absolutely my job description.
It's interesting what you were saying about you know, how quick culture rewrites history, because, you know, he was doing these shows when those battles were still being fought. It wasn't even, here's what I saw a few years ago. It's like, here's what's happening now. It was fake news. At the turn of the century, he was literally the most famous American in the world. And when he was in Europe, when he was in Paris on tour, he went to the top of the Eiffel Tower and he met my great-grandmother. Yeah, really?
Really?
Yeah.
What was she doing up there?
I don't know is the answer. But it's one of those things in our family that a few years ago we kind of looked into and went, is this actually true? And it seems like it is.
Good Lord. Sorry, because of your performance background, I imagine that your great-grandma had a... what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, come on, Benjamin. that she basically had a small fortune teller's teepee at the top. And that's what Wild Bill, what Buffalo Bill went up there to get done, to have his fortune read.
Yeah, no, I do not come from a performing family. Both my parents are librarians. Sorry.
That's amazing. I knew he'd been there because I think it was just the year the Eiffel Tower opened as well. He went.
It was
there for
a huge press event, and for somehow, my great grandmother had got herself in. He is my worst cowboy. The idea that one man's vision, fueled by the vanity of a showbiz impresario, created a historic lie that people still believe 100 years later. Bad cowboy.
Yeah.
Bad cowboy. Bad cowboy. Bad cowboy. Back to your ranch. To begin with, gentlemen, can either of you tell me the identity of Samuel Michelangelo Rosenbaum?
Is this going to be the real name of someone very famous, is it?
Yes, it is.
That's not the Sundance Kid, because that's not his name.
No, not at all.
That's not Billy the Kid.
No, not at all. And, you know, I appreciate it. It's a tricky one because we've got a biblical name, a Renaissance name, and then a very Jewish name.
It's ticking a lot of the boxes. How famous are we talking? Like, is this...
I mean, this guy is iconic, and like certainly an iconic part of my childhood as well.
The Lone Ranger?
Nope.
Tonto.
That would be a great twist if Tonto was Jewish.
Silver, the horse.
Yeah, yes, so he was a Jewish horse. No, it is the full name of Yosemite Sam.
Oh, come on.
Is it? No. Yeah. Fuck off.
And Yosemite...
How did he get past? Oh, no, he's not a Disney, is he? He's not Disney.
No, he's...
Because how did he get past Walt's ardent anti-Semitism?
Is Yosemite pronounced Yosemite, then?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Has that Easter egg been in front of us for 70 years and we've never seen it? My word, what a thing you found there, Matt.
Wow.
So, Yosemite Sam was brought into existence by Looney Tunes because basically Elmer Fudd was considered too good-natured and too mild-mannered and too gullible an antagonist to Bugs Bunny. And so instead, his creator decided that there needed to be someone much more violent, much more belligerent, and not at all a pushover in the way that Elmer Fudd was.
This is Fritz Freleng, who's yes. created a lot of the Looney Tunes stuff, yeah.
Correct.
But is he Mel Blanc? He's a Mel Blanc. I presume he's a Mel Blanc voice.
He is a Mel Blanc voice. While we're on the topic, he isn't solely voiced by Mel Blanc because Mel Blanc found his voice so hard to do because it was a proper turn it up to 11 voice. And so Blanc said he had to record Yosemite Sam's voice at the end of a day's recording. Otherwise, he would just lose it. He found his voice inspired by a fit of road rage one day. So Mel Blanc lost his rag on a highway somewhere and was like, aha, I've got it. There's Yosemite Sam. And eventually, his voice had to be taken over by a guy called Joe Alasky. And it was while Mel Blanc was still alive, because Mel Blanc just didn't have the range anymore. And it's Joe Alasky who voices Yosemite Sam in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, making him one of the few cartoon characters that was created by Blanc, but voiced by someone else during his lifetime.
Ah, cool.
And I found the first ever words said by Yosemite Sam, I've got a really odd name drop in them. He says, "Why, everybody knows me. I'm Yosemite Sam, the meanest, toughest, rip-roaringest, Edward Everett Hortonest hombre, whatever packed a six-shooter. That's who I am." So obviously, I had to look up who Edward Everett Horton was. And he was an American...
You're going to tell me that's the real name of Elmer Fudd?
Oh my God, imagine. Imagine, no. He was a well-respected character actor in film, theatre, radio, voice work. Lovely bit of background about him. He was a bit of a prankster as a student at Oberlin College in Ohio. He was asked to leave after he climbed to the top of a building on campus, waited for a crowd to gather, and then threw a dummy off. which is real Animal House behaviour.
Wow.
Yeah. My three favourite things about him are this. He has proper cartoon pedigree because he was the voice of the narrator in the Rocky and Bullwinkle show.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. He also portrayed a villain in Adam West's Batman, being the sidekick to Vincent Price's Egghead, known as Chief Screaming Chicken. Haven't looked it up, but I feel like that one's not going to get past the politically correct censors in 2021.
No.
But my favourite thing about him is that, according to the Wikipedia entry that I read, he cultivated his own special variation of the double take. That's right. He invented a double take. Apparently, he would smile ingratiatingly, not in agreement to what had just happened, and then, when realization set in, his facial features would collapse entirely into a sober, troubled mask.
Ooh.
I know, right?
I guess that's one of those you had to be there.
Yeah, I imagine so. So next I looked at something which listeners of the podcast will be unsurprised that we ended up at. It's time for some evangelical Christianity, gentlemen. Because in America, there are upwards of 5,000 cowboy churches which meld cowboy culture with evangelical Christianity. They meet typically in a rural barn or an outhouse or a old Western building. There is a country gospel band, and baptisms are done in a stock tank, which is where you would normally find water for either cattle to drink or bathe in.
Right.
Yeah. The cowboy churches tend to be in the same areas where rodeos take place. And according to the article I read, sermons given by the pastors there tend to be short and monosyllabic in order to be best understood by the congregation. They were created in 1972 by a man called Glenn Smith, who is a professional rodeo clown. And
Glenn Ron Hubbard.
Yeah. Yes. Who found God / a better grift.
Yeah,
and
wow.
When collections are done at the end of a service, then the money is simply placed in a boot, a hat, or a wooden birdhouse at the entrance of the meeting room.
Oh, fuck. This just sounds like it's trying way too hard, doesn't it?
Just a little bit. Just a little bit. Next, I very briefly, given a steer by Isabel, our Patreon donor, had a look at the history of transgender culture in the Wild West, because like she said, she'd been looking into it and that there's absolutely loads of it. So I absolutely scraped the surface on this, but I think from what I glean, it's a little bit like women dressing up as men to be able to go to war in World War One. But that was sort of a means to an end. I think this was very much one of the easiest ways for trans men to live the life they wanted to live in that era. So one example I found is someone called Harry Allen, who was one of the most notorious men in the Pacific Northwest. Allen found his fortune, escaped the law, and started a new life. He was a rabble-rouser, another great Western word in the 1890s, in and out of jail for theft, vagrancy, bootlegging, and Allen insisted on dressing as a cowboy, keeping his hair trimmed, speaking in a baritone, but Allen was assigned female at birth. It seemed that Allen was much more comfortable living life as a man and as quite the rogue as well. The historian Peter Boag, who wrote a book called Redressing America's Frontier Pass, stumbled upon hundreds and hundreds of stories of people who lived lives similar to this. His research began in the Pacific Northwest, but has gone all the way down to towns west of the Mississippi as part of the California Gold Rush, and indeed before that in the Alaskan Gold Rush. And Berg says his theory is that people who were transgender in the East could read these stories that gave a kind of validation to their lives. They saw the West as a place where they could live and get jobs and carry on a life that couldn't have existed in the more congested East. These lives were written down in the annals of the Old West, and obviously were probably hidden away in the more prudish 50s and 60s, but at the time they were made available, and it would seem that there may have been a, well, when I say an exodus, that maybe over-eggs the size of the people, but an exodus from the East to the West where people were able to live those more true to themselves lives.
I love hidden histories like that, and like you say, they get brushed and washed away in the early half of the 20th century and forgotten about, but we've always been here.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's like you talked about when we did the World's Worst Pirate of about, what's the book you always talk about?
Sodomy and the Pirate Tradition.
Yeah, but there must have been, and I'm sure we talked about it as well, there must have been trans pirates as well. Just because
absolutely.
International waters make that sort of life a lot easier to live.
Yeah.
One last thing before we go to my choice. You mentioned briefly the town of Tombstone in Arizona. In a story that ran in the Tombstone Epitaph in April 1890, there was a story of a couple of cowboys coming across a winged monster resembling a huge alligator with an extremely elongated tail, an immense pair of wings found in the desert between Whetstone and Huachua. And basically what these two cowboys claimed to have found was a Thunderbird. And I'm not talking about, you know, Virgil and his mates in 1-5, about the Native American mythological beast that I imagine is a kissing cousin of our friend, the Ouzel Finch.
Yeah, well, it's like a basically like a flying dinosaur, dragon sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the Thunderbird is found a lot on totem poles. You know, it has wings the size of an airplane, and when it beats them, that's what makes the thunder comes. And there is this infamous photo of men holding up what looks like, as you say, it looks like a pterodactyl. Now, it's obviously a fake, because they don't exist. But what is believed has happened is that Tombstone was a town in trouble, as many towns in the late 19th century in the Old West were. And so they basically went down the route of the old Chinese guy in Tremors, who I've watched Tremors recently, you know, when they find the first underground beast and it's got the weird snake tongue, and then he takes it and takes it back to his store and charges $15 a pop to have a photograph with it. Well, clearly this story was drummed up as an attempt to bring commerce into town, but the local Chamber of Commerce was not interested in exploiting this creature. But this rumour about the Thunderbird, there is only one record of it at the time, and it was only resurrected in the 1960s as an attempt to sort of reinvigorate the myths of the Weird West. So I guess in a way, in the way that the 1950s tried to dampen down the reality of queer people, they sought to replace them with Thunderbirds and pterodactyls.
I'm really looking forward to going to Thunderbird Pride, though, next summer. That's
going to be great.
It's going to rain.
Yeah.
But for my world's worst cowboy, we don't go to the Old West, gentlemen. We don't go anywhere near it. Instead, we go to Falkirk, because I found a story that is heartwarming. I should say, for our non-British listeners, Falkirk is in the middle of Scotland. In the 1970s, there was a huge aluminium industry there, and most of the workers there would often spend their spare time playing darts or snooker or watching the football. However, a few of them were enthusiastic watchers of cowboy films. And much in the spirit, I think, of the men and women we talked about in our Nollywood episode with Ola, they decided to remake some of their favourite cowboy classics.
In Falkirk.
So chief among them was a man who was a forklift truck driver called Rab Harvey, and he was in the centre of the Falkirk film industry because he owned a Super 8 camera. And along with his pals, they made short films with titles such as Apache Ambush, Border Bad Men, and The Lonesome Drifter, along with several of his pals. And they would dress up in cowboy gear with guns and holsters and hats and go to work on these scripts. And he said, Rob, that they were reliving their school days, you know, replaying games of cowboys and Indians. When it came to the casting, his friend Dennis was the hero for the very simple reason that he was the only one who could ride a horse. Another of his pals often played Indians because...
Sorry, they're making a cowboy film in which only one of the actors can ride a horse.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yep. another one volunteered to play the Native Americans because he enjoyed cutting people's throats. Let's not look into that too much. Obviously, there was a homemade aesthetic to the whole business. For example, the same actor often had to reprise parts. In one movie, one of them got killed 6 times in a single story. There was one movie in which, you know, they eventually went making shorts. So they made a long feature of 21 minutes long that included edits, sound effects and overdubs. They brought in some of the wives of the cast to play saloon girls. They filmed the saloon in a bar in Falkirk called the Victoria. And it culminates with a hanging scene in which the noose of the outlaw who is hung is made out of old car seat belts. There is a BBC documentary that was made very recently about the BA Cowboys, and it uses footage from the 70s from the BBC magazine programme Nationwide. The reporter, Bernard Falk, is sent there to spend the day with him, and he ends up tied to a tree in Callander Park as they ride around it pretending to be cowboys and Indians.
And he's still there to this day. Yeah. That is amazing.
Yeah, on one occasion, the local police turned up because some people watched them filming the gunplay. And the police sort of turned up, saw what they were doing, and then went about their business. But they're good-hearted lads. They're good-hearted lads because they gained quite a reputation for showing their films in order to raise money for wheelchairs for children with spina bifida. Which is lovely and heartwarming. Nice. And where did they show these films, gentlemen? Well, sometimes to pensioners and sometimes at children's parties.
Hanging and all.
Yeah. So my nomination for the world's worst cowboys are the toughest men in the wild west of Scotland. Our nominees for the world's worst cowboy are Barry's nomination of Buffalo Bill Cody, the man who exported the myth of the Old West and airbrushed out women and African Americans and queer people and indeed the reality of it. Or Matt's nomination of Buffalo Bill Cody, who propagated the myth of the Old West to Europe whilst yada yada yada. Or my nomination of a group of men from Falkirk in Scotland who somehow managed to be more authentic to the reality of cowboys than Buffalo Bill Cody. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's tough because I feel like my lads from Falkirk hit an absolute sweet spot of this podcast. But Buffalo Bill is responsible for so much misrepresentation of the Old West.
And killing so many buffalo.
And killing so many buffalo.
It's because he wanted to be the only buffalo left.
Yes.
Ah,
yeah.
It was all a scheme.
What do you reckon, lads?
I'm all for Buffalo Bill all day, all night. The lovely lads from Falkirk with the charity films. We can't call them the world's worst cowboys.
It feels like if we knew more about them, they might qualify. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, to be fair, yeah, they might be, you know. They might be massive racists.
It just feels like if we knew more about them, we'd go, oh yeah, okay, they're definitely the worst.
Yeah, that's fair. The films are ramshackle, but there is such a warm heart behind them that it seems unfair.
I'm imagining they're gonna have that homemade, slightly like the scenery is wobbly and there's a a British police constable standing in the background watching on with a bored expression in most shots.
Yeah.
And things like that.
I wouldn't be surprised if we at some point in the future found out that one of those six deaths was real. Yeah. No, the whole thing was a cover.
What an elaborate cover story. In that case, you've attempted to swing it back my way, but no, not once, but twice, ladies and gentlemen. Buffalo Bill Cody is the world's worst cowboy.
Yes.
Before we go, it's time for the world's best news of the week, which we've said we'll continue until this pandemic is over, which seems quite an imprecise metric. But I feel, Barry, like we're going to get through the winter and the spring and then we'll readjust our sights. But my nomination for this week is sort of covers both bases, because we're going to Bristol and we're going to a story that many of you might have seen in the news. It popped up on our Discord you guys need to know about this. And it echoes a previous entry on World's Worst Race, because Omar Ahmed is a runner, and he had originally signed up to run a 10K race in Bristol, but accidentally ended up running and winning the Bristol Half Marathon in a remarkable time of just 63 minutes. However, he went the wrong way when he reached the point where the courses diverged and was understandably disqualified, even though he'd run the half marathon. The Great Run Company said that Mr. Ahmed, whose first name was spelt incorrectly on his race number, entered the 10K as an elite runner, but not the half marathon. Therefore, he was not officially part of the half marathon race and unfortunately would have to be disqualified.
Justice. In injustice, I say.
Yeah, rather magnanimously, the chief executive of the Great Run Company added, rules are rules, and in this case, we say we have to disqualify Omar. We salute his performance, and he has been invited to take part in next week's Great Manchester Run as an elite athlete. Of course, we also look forward to welcoming him back to Bristol for 2022's Great Bristol Run, and we hope that he enters into the right race that time.
Wow, shade.
Yeah. But I could not mention that because it's just such a wonderful, wonderful story. Before we go, Matt, where can we find you and what can we find you doing when we get there?
I infect the internet like a virus. It's Matt Ricardo, 1T in Matt on Twitter and Instagram. Because I am a live performer, and I don't know if you're news junkies, but there's been this pandemic thing going on. So I haven't been doing much live work. So I've been doing a lot of stuff on my podcast and on YouTube. So my YouTube channel, Matt Ricardo, my podcast, Imagination and Junk, which is a conversation about creativity between me and an American author. And we have never actually met.
Nice.
Ooh.
Marvellous stuff. Well, we're all off to recreate the Highland Clearances whilst dressed as Jesse James. Until next time, goodbye.